In our last episode, I had a major oopsie. Almost finished with the recording on our three tools for our Enhancement Writer's Toolbox, Imagery, Archetypes, and Illusion. And I glanced up and realized the recording had approached 40 minutes. I stumble over words and pause and take long breaths, but I wouldn't have enough errors to lose 20 minutes. I can accept reaching 25 minutes. We recently had a half-hour episode, part one of Symbols, but multiple half-hour episodes are 40 minutes? That defeats the right focus's stated length. Time for a quick commute, short walk, or a fast prep for a simple meal. I originally placed archetype and illusion with imagery because we have a lot of phrases that carry a wealth of detail. Therefore, rather than run 40 minutes, that episode is now divided. Imagery last week, archetypes and illusion this week, and next week we finish off the interpretive realm with allegory. On to this week's episode. Welcome to The Right Focus, a podcast for writers, newbies and veterans, and everyone in between. We're hosted by M.A. Lee with the assistance of Remy Black and Edie Runes, all from Writers Inc. Books. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. Each episode lasts as long as it takes to fix a quick dinner, grab a short commute, or take a brisk walk. Resources and links are in the show notes. Visit us at therightfocus.blogspot.com. Now, on to this week's episode. We've entered the realm of imagery, known as archetypes. Archetypes function like symbols, a concrete item that stands for an idea. These terms are distinguished by the global recognition of an archetype. That is, an archetype is understood by the educated public and cultures worldwide. Arche means chief, and type equals kind, a pattern or model that has existed for millennia and crosses all cultures. In Discovering Characters and Discovering Plot, two other books in my Discovering series, I explain the archetypes of characters and plot structure. Carl Jung's 12 archetypal characters create a strong foundation for behavior analysis and character development. Writers seeking help with plot can find no better method than the archetypal story pattern. Using ASP will keep plots out of the poison of slow pacing. Archetypes and tropes are basically the same thing. Tropes, however, risk becoming cliches. Tropes are often distinguished from archetypes as story elements, while archetypes are story details. We can attract people to stories with these base elements. Happy hiker meets deep woods Sasquatch. Hooker with a heart of gold saves crooked cop. Rags to riches Cinderella. Beauty meets beast. The mad scientist pursued by his monster. We enjoy twist on archetype, such as the nagging wife threatening her husband with a mental institution, only to be the one carried off in James Thurber's Unicorn in the Garden, or the helpful yet ditzy housewife who fed the detectives investigating her husband's death a wonderfully roasted leg of lamb, which happens to be the murder weapon in Roald Dahl's Lamb to the Slaughter. When the base element is that but nothing more, we have a stereotype, a flat-bored character. The word trope is from the Latin tropus and the Greek tropos, meaning a turn, a figure of speech. Trope is currently in favor, while archetype blew across the culture a couple of decades ago. Give it a few more years, and we'll be on to something else. Just remember that trope basically means archetype, and develop your characters and events so they have opinion and angst in order to avoid stereotypes. Easily findable on the internet are list upon list, pages upon pages of archetypes and tropes. Books claim to list and explain the very tropes you must have in your book. Pinterest will offer the 17 characters every book needs and 20 events every plot has to have, 6 types of villains, 33 allies, and many, many more claims for crafting the successful story or novel. Let me just give you a list of 10 items to give you an idea what to look for. In Shapes and Concept, a cross represents the tree of life, the axis of the world, or martyrdom. A circle is eternity, unity, oneness, our intellect. The spiral is growth, deepening, cosmic evolution, a microcosm. Fire is transformative, passion, or regeneration. Water is a life force, or mystery. Stars are guidance. The crescent moon is change or transition. A mountain is ambition and goals. A valley is depression, evil, and the unknown. The rain is a life giver. Skeletons and bones equal mortality. Now here's a list of about 5 situation archetypes. Initiation is the rite of passage. Quest, our task to perform. Apotheosis is becoming godlike. You also see that with transcendence, entering a higher realm. The fall, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. Good versus evil, rebirth after death, nature versus the mechanistic world, innate wisdom versus educated stupidity. Illusion is our next focus. Both illusion, spelled with an A, and illusion spelled with an I, come from the same Latin root of ludere, meaning to play. They sound so similar that people, especially students, confuse them constantly. The illusion, starting with the letter I, is a mirage, an image that you think is there but is not. Remember, the I of that illusion is something that you see or think you see with your eye. It can be a magical trick or a fantastical hallucination, like Macbeth's vision of the dagger. Our illusion, starting with the letter A, means to refer to something. Illusions are references to art, literature, painting, specific artistic forms that are unchanging, such as the ballet Swan Lake, famous people, and famous historical events. These are specific items, not necessarily concrete, but definitely determined in meaning. As simple, quick references, they can have a huge impact for our readers. The 3 most used sources for literary allusions are Greek and Roman mythology, the Bible, and Shakespeare, believe it or not. Pop culture also provides sources, such as the Death Star of Star Wars, or a Dementor out of the Harry Potter stories, or Gollum from the Lord of the Rings. Fairy tales, songs, paintings, and more can become referential sources. A recently titled book is What Happens in Paradise? This is an allusion to the pop culture saying of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Before we begin reading, the allusion gives us an idea of how the story will work its reference to Vegas. Like symbols and symbolic imagery, allusions unlock additional meaning. We need to say or write only a couple of words, and most people have an immediate connection to what we're talking about, either through education or through use in other media or through pop culture references. I say cowardly lion, and most people in America will know the reference to the Wizard of Oz. I say she wore her hair like Princess Leia, and everyone in the know thinks of the cinnamon roll buns covering Leia's ears. I say Naomi and Ruth, and most people immediately think of the Bible story, just as they do in the wedding ceremony when we say, "Whether thou goest, I will go," which is also an allusion to the Naomi and Ruth story. Here's the danger with allusions. When the culture at large no longer understands the meaning, should the writer restrict the allusions used? T.S. Eliot certainly didn't think so when he penned The Wasteland with all of those allusions that he certainly did expect everyone to understand. I say Midas, people immediately think of the man who had the golden touch. Not everyone will know the alternate endings to the story. In my preferred story, and there is another one out there, just as Midas celebrates his gold gift from the gods, his young daughter runs to embrace him. Before he can stop her, she flings her arms around him and turns to gold. A most cherished gift is now despised because it caused a great loss. In such cases, when the illusion can be confused, we writers need to add another element to guide people to the story we want them to think of. Maybe I would need to add nothing more than loss of his daughter or despised gold gift. While Shakespeare is one of the most common sources for allusions, he drew his allusions from classical mythology. In Romeo and Juliet, he has more than 20 allusions that I can think of immediately. Aurora, Cupid, Diana, Venus, Vestal for Hestia, Jove, Echo, Titan, Orion, Persephone, which is a perfect example of an oblique allusion. Hades is death personified. Romeo kills people. Juliet, therefore, is Persephone. The allusions open up little bits of meaning, and the informed reader nods and sees windows open and doors flung wide for more comprehension of the story, connections that others didn't see. Most allusions that we encounter are direct allusions. A self-referent allusion is a reference to another part of the work being read or a reference to another work in the writer's whole body of works. The oblique allusion occurs when only a faint clue is given to the source reference. The perfect example of an oblique illusion is the poem The Chambered Nautilus by Oliver Wendell Holmes. The persona is contemplating his life, his internal soul, and the existence after this one. He lifts an empty chambered nautilus shell to the sky so the sun will go through it and he can see the interior chambers. Then he addresses it with an apostrophe and continues on to address his own soul in another apostrophe. O my soul, till thou at length art free. How is this an oblique illusion? Well, where else in literature does someone lift up the outer shell that held a person's essence? I'll give you a clue. The shell is like a bony vessel of our body. Was that strong enough? I'll give you another clue. In only a couple of acts before, the protagonist contemplated his own afterlife when he wondered what would happen if he died. Did you get it? Did you guess Hamlet? 'Cause it is Hamlet. When he lifts Yorick's skull to the air and addresses him, alas, poor Yorick, I knew him, Horatio, a fellow of infinite jest. What does Oliver Wendell Holmes want us to think about the chambered nautilus when he does this oblique allusion to the skull that Hamlet lifts? That's just one allusion to Shakespeare's works. Many more are out there. Every time someone writes about unwashable bloody hands or has a character say, out damn spot, we have Macbeth. We can allude to Puck's impish mischief when someone can out-Hamlet Hamlet with their procrastination, or have a love like Romeo and Juliet, or have an old fool like Lear, or snapping couples like Beatrice and Benedict. These are just a few of allusions that can be made. How many of these classical mythology options for allusions do you know? Jason and the Golden Fleece, Paris and the Golden Apple, Arachne and Athena, Pygmalion and Galatea, Daedalus and Icarus, Theseus, Ariadne, and the Minotaur, Pandora's Box, Alexander the Great, and the Gordian Knot. Now, this is a historical event of ancient Greece, not myth. But still, we can make allusions to it. Here are some biblical allusions from the Old Testament. The Garden of Eden, the Forbidden Fruit, Cain and Abel, My Brother's Keeper, Eye for an Eye, Tooth for a Tooth, Sodom and Gomorrah, the rescue of the child Moses, the passage of the Red Sea, to everything there is a season, my cup runneth over, Daniel and the lion's den, the fiery furnace with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. From the New Testament, Good Samaritan, and many other parables are known simply by the name of the parable, such as prodigal son, or betrayed with a kiss, 30 pieces of silver, casting the first stone, doubting Thomas, living water, turn the other cheek, the straight and narrow way. We can do more with allusions than a quick reference. Borden Deal used the Greek mythological story of Antaeus to structure his story of the same name. Antaeus was a son of Mother Earth who was ravaging the world. Hercules stopped his evil against humans. In the fight between Hercules and Antaeus, whenever Antaeus was in connection with the ground, his strength increased. When he did not touch the ground, he weakened. Hercules defeated him by holding him in the air until Antaeus weakened enough that he could be killed. In Borden Deal's story, a young farm boy moves with his family to the big city. It's wartime, and the father is absent. He meets a gang of other boys and joins them. A gang in Borden Deal's story simply means boys who run around together. Deal's description of the boy evokes the sky and the flaxen fields of grain in the way he describes eyes and hairs. He is of sturdier stock than the city boys. While the other boys just want to hang out, the farm boy wants something to do, some way to work the land, a purpose, a goal that will reach fruition. But where in the city can they find free land? On a rooftop. They cart up soil and create a rooftop garden. The farm boy knows the best dirt, helps them smooth the dirt over the roof, sniffs the dirt to know when it's time for planting, because his seasons are delayed, moving from Alabama to a northern, colder clime. The boys want to grow what they see as a sign of wealth, grass and trees. They're not interested in his choice of cucumbers and corn, so they settle on grass to grow. It takes a while for grass seedlings to start, that northern climate creating problems again. When the seedlings finally poke through the soil, everyone is in awe. They had originally planned to lay on the grass, but the one boy who steps on it quickly draws back. It has become sacred ground to them, and they simply want to look at it and admire it. We have the Antaeus character, who has made his connection with the ground. It's time for the Hercules figure to enter and to separate this farm boy and the others from the land that they have. The weight of the rooftop garden has caused leaks in the roof of the building, and the owner of the building and other men come to check out the problem. Once they see the rooftop garden of soil and grass, they resolve to destroy it. The boys destroy the garden rather than let the men do it. Then, sucking the essence from a single grass blade, the farm boy leaves, never to be seen again. They find him, weeks later, walking along the railroad tracks in Nashville. He never makes it back to his own land. I'll let you know if Bordendale's story is a tragedy or not. Look to the illusion. We have one more tool in our interpretation toolbox, allegory, and I have two famous poems to guide us to an understanding of how to use allegory in our own work. One hint, the eagle has landed. Join us for allegory next week on The Right Focus. And let our spirit be willing, but our flesh may be weak. Inspiration comes from Natalia Ginsburg. When I sit down to write, she says, I feel extraordinarily at ease, and I move in an element which seems to me I know extraordinarily well. I use tools that are familiar to me, and they fit snugly in my hands. Thanks for listening to The Right Focus, a podcast for writers at all levels, hosted by Emma Lee from Writers Inc. Books, assisted by Remy Black and Edie Runes. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. Music is licensed through Audio Jungle, called Background Music Loop. Its creator is Alexander Polishchuk, known on Audio Jungle as Plastic 3. The music comes in different iterations. Show notes and resource links for this and other episodes can be found at therightfocus.blogspot.com. Write to us at winkbooks@aol.com when you have questions, comments, and speculations. We will try to answer you as quickly as possible. By the way, we will not mine your email address. That's rude. If you find value in our content, share with your writing friends or write a review. We're small beans here without the advertising budget of the big peeps, and you can make a difference. And whatever occurs, right on.